The truth is the assets that we like within the retail space are largely institutionally owned today. And those guys don't sell, for the most part, with very few exceptions, won't sell off market. It's just different than multifamily where, you know, there are 1,000 apartment buildings in every city and you walk around and find owners.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Philip Block is the founding partner of LBX Investments. Philip, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Hey, man, the pleasure's mine. The same three questions I ask every guest who comes on the show. Can you tell us in 90 seconds or less where you started, where you are now, and how you got there?
Sure. Yeah, I grew up in Philadelphia, but I worked in New York with my now partner, Rob Levy, at a company called Centerline Capital Group, which was largely a multifamily finance company. But we owned C3, which was a special servicing business, and a bunch of other businesses. We sold that in a kind of a series of transactions. I moved to Los Angeles, Rob stayed in New York, and we decided to partner. And we both had histories in retail and started focusing on shopping centers, largely in the Southeast. So that's what we're doing now.
And that's fantastic. You know, that doesn't give us that much light into what you guys are doing, because you guys are doing some humongous transactions. You own quite a bit of assets. And I think you've learned some really incredible lessons here in the last even few years, because as I followed what you guys have been doing, what makes sense right now in retail?
Oh, man, it is a crazy, crazy market. There's no doubt. You know, I think what a lot of people have said and what we saw is from the beginning of the pandemic, it kind of highlighted and accentuated things that were already happening, trends that you were already seeing. So we have always been focused on kind of open air, grocer, discount oriented stuff. And as I mentioned, we focused on the Southeast, even though I'm in California and Rob's in New York. And the reason for that was we like the regulatory environment. We like the demographic trends. And what you saw was obviously everybody caught on to that. So now, you know, we didn't anticipate COVID by any stretch, but we did like the regulatory environment, which is now creating a big rush to those states from places like New York and California. And we're the beneficiaries of that from an investment standpoint. And I think that is absolutely going to continue to trend. The challenge is that so much capital has come into that space, and you're seeing grocer deals in the Southeast trade, you know, 200, 300 basis points tighter than we saw 4 or 5 years ago. I mean, it's pretty wild, honestly, but the performance is proving that out, right? Because the whole story when we started 5-ish years ago was Amazon's taking over the world, it's e-commerce, retail's dead. And we said, this is oversold. That doesn't make a ton of sense to us. Right. And which is why we focused on what we focused on, the kind of grocer and the necessity stuff. Well, that's continued to perform. And I think what you're seeing, which makes sense, is cap rates are responding. And you're saying there is a stability of cash flow here. It's the mall space is brutal. Buying B, C, D malls is, you know, that's a tough space. There are a lot of great groups doing redevelopment of some of those. It's not really where we focus, but a lot of that can make some sense. People trying to find, you know, new uses, whether that's storage or hotel or, you know, multifamily. Everybody wants to put multifamily everywhere if you can, which makes a lot of sense. So I think all those trends are going to continue, and it's interesting to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. But you guys are branching even out of the grocery store anchored centers as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, I said with grocer and kind of discount stuff, largely, we always kind of stay there. So we haven't been exclusive to grocer. It depends how you think about Target and kind of Walmart, because typically we own 3 or 4 Target centers. Where Target does grocer, obviously we don't own the Target, but it does provide the kind of base next to you. So maybe you don't have the income from them, but it's driving the traffic and the co-tenancy that you want.
Right.
And we're expanding geographically too. I mean, I think one of the things we saw, listen, when somebody zigs, I just naturally zag like that. There's just kind of inherent in what and who I am, I guess. But when you see all capital chasing one thing, it's great for our existing portfolio. It makes it less interesting to buy stuff because I'm not interested in buying things for a 6% return. It's just, I'm not BREIT Blackstone, you know, trying to hit a 5. That's just not that interesting. But is capital going to come to the Midwest? The Northeast markets are still strong. It's not like Philadelphia, for instance, and New York are gone, right? You don't have millions of people deserting. There's still great markets that were dense and probably oversupplied. Buying the better assets in those markets still make sense. You know, we're not going to do that exclusively, but we are branching out to try to find opportunities.
Right. Yeah, that's absolutely fantastic. 2021 was a little bit of a slower deal flow year for you, though you guys did still take a couple of, you know, really interesting assets down. Talk to us about kind of what you saw in 2021 that made you slow down. And then what do you project for 2022?
Well, you know, it's probably a 3-month kind of ramp up period from when a deal gets launched by a broker or a seller decides to take it to market. And so the beginning of 2021, to be honest, there just wasn't much on the market. There was nothing kind of coming out of 2020 that was interesting. And then starting kind of Q1, Q2, you started to see some sellers back as there was some more stability kind of, won't say post-COVID, because obviously we're not post-COVID, but post the initial shock of COVID, I guess. So we were able, it was a bit of a slower year, but we bought two fantastic assets. As you said, we bought a large shopping center outside of Chicago. It was a Whole Foods anchored center, really well leased, that just traded, to be honest, at a cap rate that didn't make a lot of sense at the time. You know, we bought it at an 8 cap or something in place, and it's going to widen because we've got some increases in income coming. And that's, you know, today, that's probably a 6 cap. I mean, we just stole it, to be honest. It was a great, great asset for us. And we bought a great deal in Memphis, in Germantown, which is kind of the only submarket in Memphis that we really like a lot. And we talked about it before the show, but the REI, Target, Best Buy, just a fantastic asset there as well, with a bit of lease up to do. So we're thrilled with the assets we bought. And now what's interesting is the amount of capital, not just in retail, obviously kind of everywhere, that has flooded the market. I think just the pent-up demand is what we've seen. And certainly the non-traded REITs, the NTRs, the BREITs and Starwoods of the world are just kind of pushing pricing to levels that we've never seen. I mean, right, industrial and multifamily deals trading sub-3 caps. That everything trickles down, you know, so you say that, and then people who are agnostic to asset class start looking at retail and hospitality and office, and, you know, everything compresses. So we're seeing that, and I think that trend's going to continue. My general view is if you are focused on an asset class and a market and you know that asset really well, you're going to find opportunities, right? From a macro standpoint, I don't love multifamily today. I love multifamily as a general asset class, but it's a challenging asset class. But I know a lot of really smart multifamily guys who that's all they do, and they find great opportunities. And right. So, but I think I still love the retail space, partly because we know it so well and been focused there for a while, and partly because there's still a gap and kind of a spread differentiation between that and other asset classes that's probably overdone, oversold in some cases.
You guys had some unique approaches when the pandemic first came on to how you worked with both your regional tenants, or I guess I'll call it your local tenants. I'm probably not even using the right word. So, you know, fill in the blank here if I'm using the wrong terminology. But the local owner operators of businesses, and then you had some national tenants, I think they kind of just said, hey, we're not paying you, good luck. I mean, how did you navigate all of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's challenging. First of all, I've got a great team, really fortunate for that. And our property managers and asset managers are kind of all over this. But the nationals, this isn't unique to what we experienced, but some of the nationals, and I'll refrain from naming names here, are more challenging to deal with. And that's largely because they have a huge team of lawyers in-house and they know you need them, which is kind of messed up if you think about the reason that investors want the national tenants, and everyone uses Ross, I'll use Ross, like a Ross of the world, is for their credit.
Right.
If they stop paying when things get tough, what's their credit worth? It's not worth anything. So it's a bit of a strange dynamic there. Meanwhile, the mom and pops were fighting like hell to survive. And now we benefited certainly from being in the Southeast, as I mentioned, because in a bunch of these places, you know, COVID didn't exist. At least they didn't believe it did. So, which is great. You know, people are out shopping. Again, grocers absolutely crushed it. I mean, the sales on grocers nationally is up like 20-30%. I think inflation probably benefits them. I'm not really sure. You know, so you're seeing a lot of that, a lot of people staying at home more, but, you know, cooking at home instead of going out to restaurants. And we worked with everybody. I mean, we said from the start, first of all, we wanted to help people get PPP funds and work with governments and to do whatever they could. And we restructured some stuff and we moved some things back in. The guys that we wanted long-term, this was an opportunity to extend them long-term because we felt like they would come out of the pandemic doing well and we'd both benefit from that. And we've seen that. And, you know, because we tracked it so closely and worked so closely, we collected, you know, 90%+ of rent every month through kind of even the worst parts of the cycle, and have, you know, come out a lot stronger, to be honest, today. Our income's up, occupancy's up, it's looking great.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting strategy I'd forgotten about, because again, I tracked your newsletters and kind of read what you guys were doing. And you said, hey, in exchange for maybe deferring some of your payments, we're going to go ahead and rework this lease. We're going to make sure that, you know, you lock in a longer period there, which I thought was really, really creative to give, you know, give a little to get a little on some of those ways you guys work those out. So that's really, really cool. I may have asked this question, and I know you answered it in a way by saying, if you're in multifamily, you know, you're going to find opportunity, but what are some ways that you guys are, you know, finding opportunity right now? And what do you see going forward in 2022?
Yeah, I mean, the truth is the assets that we like within the retail space are largely institutionally owned today. And those guys don't sell, for the most part, with very few exceptions, won't sell off market. It's just different than multifamily, where, you know, there are 1,000 apartment buildings in every city and you walk around and find owners. So these are largely owned by REITs and other institutions. And so they're bringing them out from brokers. So my job, honestly, is we have to know every deal and every broker and these sellers directly. So we speak to the, you know, I have close relationships with a lot of the guys at the REITs and the institutions, and they'll say, we're bringing this to market. This is what we want. You know, so-and-so JLL is going to take it out for us. And we just want to show it to four or five guys because we have to tell our board, we made a market for this. This was the market price, which makes a lot of sense. And we are working with some of the bigger guys about doing some kind of larger portfolio type deals, maybe off market. I'd love, you know, it hasn't happened yet for us. We've seen some of those deals happen. It would be great. So I think you're going to see some consolidation in the public REIT space, because the non-traded REITs, you know, the publics can't compete with them when they're raising the amount of capital that they're raising. Like, I think your REIT's raising, what, $2 billion a month, right? I mean, they're property agnostic. So you're putting out $6, $8 billion of real estate a month you have to buy. That's, I don't know how you do that responsibly and without buying, you know, whole companies, basically. So how do Kimco's and Regency's of the world compete with that? It's tough. So I think, you know, they kind of go down, and then the second tier, third tier of public REITs, I would expect some consolidation, which is great for us, because that means guys are disposing of assets, trying to raise better, cheaper capital, which is where we started and where we saw opportunities at the beginning. So I think we're going to continue to see that.
Right. Yeah, that's absolutely fantastic. So tell us, Philip, I mean, with that kind of on the horizon and you guys there on the acquisition side, at what point in time does it make sense for you guys to start disposing or, you know, some of your property? Do you do any of that?
Yeah, it's a really good question. The way that we think about it, and this hasn't changed, is really we have a business. When we acquire an asset, we have a specific business plan tied to that asset. It's typically kind of 3 to 5 year type business plan that involves some lease up, maybe outparcel sales, something where we're adding value. To date, there's been almost nothing that we acquired kind of strictly for yield with nothing to do. That's not super interesting. I'll say the asset, you know, to step back, the asset in Chicago we bought is kind of a long-term hold with not a ton to do, but the yield is so kind of outsized that it made a lot of sense. We have one other asset that's kind of like that we own with a family office long-term, but otherwise there's always a business plan. So we're now coming to the kind of point for a bunch of our assets where we've executed. And then it's really assessment of, do you refi or do you sell, right? You should have a capital event. We should get capital back to our investors. And one asset, so we own an asset in North Charleston, which is fantastic. We sold there were three kind of groups of outparcels. We sold them all. We leased up the rest. So it's fully done. Leases being completed right now. And then we're going to refi it initially because we need to for some of the capital. And then it's a question of long-term, do you want to own this or not? That's really, we spent a lot of time kind of thinking through basically the risks and the returns to that. If you have all the capital back and you're clipping, you know, 20% or something, it's hard. And I don't see that any real risk to that cash flow. I don't think it probably makes a ton of sense to sell for us or for our investors, right? But we want to do what makes a lot of sense for the investor community, because again, that's who's backing us and believing in us. And we're not going to hold things just to hold them. That's not particularly interesting, like, you know, just a clip. So we're kind of going through exactly that. We had actually another asset I forgot, in Fultondale, Alabama. We own just a fantastic asset. Same thing, we leased up and sold out parcels. We fully leased the center, so it's 100%. we're clipping 20% and we have a larger institutional investor in the deal that, but it's like family office, so they can be long-term. And we had a long discussion with them. You know, they said, let's sell. We bought the deal at like an 11 cap. I mean, just 10.8 cap, which is, makes no sense. A Target Center. And in their minds, they're like, we could sell it for a 7 today. That I said, if we could sell for a 7, I might do it, but we can't. It's, that's probably not, but it's not wildly off. But I said, we're clipping 20% and there's not really a risk to this. I think all of our investors, we had that discussion and then ultimately they said, we agree, we want to hold this. You know, we just showed, this is what the returns look like, holding, selling, here's where we see the risks. And we didn't see much. So we, you know, we refinanced, all the money's out of the deal and we're clipping a ridiculous number.
Yeah, man, that makes a heck of a lot of sense. That's really interesting because I know you have a background in institutional capital. And I had this discussion with you a couple of years ago and you said, man, I'd much rather work with private investors than institutional capital. Or in this case, you know, you got family offices, which is, you know, just a step above maybe private investors. Can you give us kind of some, you know, your thoughts behind that?
Yeah, listen, there's no question. I think everybody probably listening to your podcast can understand working with the bigger institutions. At the end of the day, if they give you 90% of the equity in a deal, which is a typical 90-10, they're going to call the bigger shots and they're going to have their fund life where, you know, they have to have an exit in 5 years or 7 years. So you can figure out maybe a way to buy them out at that time, but it's complicated. And we really pride ourselves on our reporting and our kind of, because we really do, I think we are alluding to, we pride ourselves and we bring kind of an institutional look and reporting and management to really a kind of a private asset class. And we want to kind of continue to do that. When you're doing it for the institutions, it's a lot of, you know, you're working with three levels of asset managers and decision makers there versus, hey, we're nimble, like let's make the right decision for our investors and move forward and just be much more flexible. Capital, less, you know, we're answering a lot less questions, that kind of thing, which of course is an advantage. It's hard to raise enough private capital to do the type of deals that we want to do. But we've been really fortunate. We performed really well and we've got a great group of investors that's continued to grow. So that's what we're doing.
Absolutely love it. Philip, let's jump here into the final four questions. The first one is this: what is one tool or resource, and think software here, that you find you can't live without?
Well, we use this AppFolio. Well, there are probably a few things, but we use AppFolio for our investor reporting system. I know there are a few out there. We used to use CrowdStreet's backend system, and then we switched to this just as a software, which is great. It's an easy way for us to communicate and distribute stuff to all of our investors. I mean, on the buy side, on the acquisition, there are a bunch of things, obviously, but we have this thing called Credit Intel, which is fantastic because it's a basically a buy side or sell side research on retail companies, public and private. They have more information on public. But when we're evaluating shopping centers and tenants that we don't know or even that we do, I can speak to an analyst. They give us their take on what's going on with that company, just like if you're buying a stock and you're speaking to a stock analyst. And so we know what their credit ratings are. We know when debt's maturing. We can figure out kind of what the right way to think about underwriting that, for that risk is.
That's fabulous. I love that. Question number two for you. What is one mistake? If you could help our listeners avoid one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
One mistake, over leverage to me is the biggest risk in real estate. I mean, a lot of people think they're really smart because they leverage the heck out of an asset and it moves in the right direction. I mean, think about how many homeowners today, right, with what's gone on in housing market over the last year or so. You have 80% financing or 90% financing or whatever people put on, and the market, you know, your house went up by 40% and you look like a genius. To me, that, you know, listen, part of this is from my experience at Centerline, and we had the largest special servicing business going through the GFC, coming out of that and seeing what leverage did to folks. And you have 80% CMBS loans that are misunderwritten. That's how you lose the asset. If you have appropriate leverage with appropriate institutions, so banks, life companies, relationship guys, you just eliminate so much of that risk because you can work through a downtime. Nobody anticipates a downtime, especially right now when things have been frothy for so long and cap rates continue to compress. At some point, we're going to have a hiccup, right? It's inevitable. And the best way to prepare yourself for that, in my view, is not having the wrong leverage and too much leverage.
Right, man. Yeah, that's absolutely true. I love that. When it comes to investing in the world, what's one thing you're doing right now to make the world a better place?
Investing in the world? Oh, man, I wish I was doing more. You know, we don't have a lot of opportunity for green type of investing ourselves. It's we're buying secondhand, so we're not developing a lot of stuff, but it's a great question, man. I think some of it, honestly, this is going to sound maybe cheesy because of the nature of the question, but if we're buying and maintaining the better shopping centers in kind of underloved markets, secondary markets around the country, and putting in and working really well with those tenants, the local tenants, the mom and pops, it's serving these communities well. And, you know, I think that's necessary for healthy communities long term.
Right. Absolutely. Philip, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, learn more about you or how to invest with you, what is the best way to do that?
Our website's the easiest. It's www.lbxinvestments.com.
LBX, that's phonetically Lima Bravo X-ray investments.com. Thank you, Philip, for coming on the show today. I do appreciate it.
Thanks so much. It was great.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen. If you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.